Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When a country is lucky, as America has been, what most people know of war and battlefronts comes secondhand through correspondence, and today through TV images. From 1939 to 1943, New Yorker magazine writer A.J. Liebling brought war, World War II, to Americans in some of the greatest war reporting of the 20th century. Now, as the country wades through another very different, distant war, we're looking back at Liebling's way of conveying what war is and what it means. This hour, On Point journalist Pete Hamill on New Yorker legend A.J. Liebling's take on war. You can join the conversation. Does one war speak to another across the years? Have you read A.J. Liebling on World War II? And how does this war, his reporting, light up the country's wars today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Later in this hour, we'll look at the life and legacy of science fiction writer and legend Arthur C. Clarke, who died yesterday at 90. But joining me now from New York City is the great Pete Hamill, a New York novelist, journalist, and sometime war correspondent himself. He's editor of a new volume from the Library of America called A.J. Liebling, World War II Writings. Pete Hamill, it's great to have you.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great to be here.
Wonderful to have you. And you picked up this project with the country in the midst of another war or two in Iraq and Afghanistan. What did it do to your sense of war to look back on A.J. Liebling's writings when we've got these bombshells, you know, blowing up all around us right now, far afield?
Well, one of the things that strikes you when you look at these pieces, particularly the previously uncollected ones, which are the way they were as sent to the New Yorker, is that World War II was an unusual war. We had not yet become a permanent warrior nation. And it was one that had to be fought. So there was no question about rooting for the other guy. Or as Murrow said at the time, there are some stories to which there are not two sides.
Right.
And the Nazis or the Holocaust that they inflicted on so many millions of people, there was no two sides to it. So the correspondents also felt, for all their own weirdnesses and diversions and ambitions, et cetera, that they were in the thing as best they could be, just like the soldiers, that they were there risking their lives because there's no correspondent in history who was bulletproof. And it was a war, particularly the part that Liebling covers in Europe, that was very dangerous in the sense that once the landing had been effected in Normandy, there was then a very tough hedgerow war that took them all the way to Paris, and then the infinitely more dangerous war as they went on from France into Germany itself.
Pete Hamill.
So,
excuse me. Sorry, Pete. I want to get into those hedgerows with you, but I'm just in the back of my mind is running. We'll have readers who know A.J. Liebling and love him well, and others who do not know him at all. And I wish you'd introduce or reintroduce him to us. David Remnick wrote in the New Yorker a couple of years ago, described him as plump and pigeon-toed with tiny, delicate hands, but also a certain confidence. For a lot of Americans, the sort of archetypal World War II correspondent was the sort of populist reporter, the everyman reporter, Ernie Pyle.
Who was a friend of Liebling and writes about him in this book.
Yes, he does, quite interestingly, and we'll look at that. But who was A.J. Liebling then? If Ernie Pyle was feeding 700 newspapers across the country, who was A.J. Liebling nourishing or delighting or informing with his writing? And who was he? What did he bring to this war?
A.J. Liebling was born in New York in 1904. He went on as a reader first, which is the first step to becoming a very good writer, reading all kinds of adventure tales and so on. His family moved from the east side to far Rockaway, if you can believe it, in a very early time. Mm. Then came the Depression. Liebling went to Dartmouth, was kicked out a couple of times because he couldn't abide going to chapel, and it was mandatory. Went to Columbia, where he tried the journalism school and wrote acerbically about it later as being a total waste of his time. it's not the same journalism school they have now, which is excellent. But he then went working at different newspapers. He worked briefly at the Times. He got fired there for making up the names of athletes in the back pages of the school sports section. Went to work in Connecticut, came back and hooked on with the World and then the New York World and then the World Telegram. He became, through the 30s, with his friend Joe Mitchell, who later became another famous New Yorker writer, he became a specialist in characters and hustlers and all the kind of people that came out of the woodwork during the Depression, in an era when some of the big gangsters were Jewish and some of the small-time guys were. And he had a real instinct and feeling for writing about those people, not exclusively. And then the war came, and the big thing about Liebling was that he had gone, his father had footed the bill in the 1920s to study in France. And he loved France above all other places, except possibly 8th Avenue and 50th Street, where Stillman's Gym was.
the eternal fan of boxing, the sweet sport.
He spoke French. He had read French history. He was a fan of Stendhal and Balzac and all kinds of other people. So when the war essentially began in 1939, the Paris correspondent for The New Yorker, Janet Flanner, had an emergency with her mother in the States and had to come back. Liebling conned Sean into sending him to France.
William Sean, the great editor
William
of The New
Yorker. Yeah. Harold Ross was actually the editor, but Sean, he knew Sean. And Harold Ross sent him, who barely spoke English in some cases, but sent them off, and he started writing this brilliant stuff. In a weird way, this book breaks down to before the war, during the war, and after the war, which was true of Liebling's generation. Everybody measured time that way. I knew him before the war. After the war, we did this. And very few of them talked big about fighting the war.
Right off the bat in this collection, in his Reflections in a Cul-de-Sac, he's got this great line right at the top, says, "There's an old proverb that a girl may sleep with one man without being a trollop, but let a man cover one little war, and he is a war correspondent." He's tweaking his own standing there. What's he telling us, Pete?
Of course. Well, what he's saying is that the one thing he learned from French literature was mocking irony, mostly directed at yourself. And he would no more land in Normandy to prove how heroic he was than he would go up on top of the Empire State Building and jump off in a parachute. Yeah. That's not what he did. He'd much prefer to have a three-course meal somewhere. So the unique thing in his prose, the thing that can't be imitated the way all great writers are, is the sense of irony. The irony was the great armor that many New Yorkers donned during the Depression to keep themselves laughing in the face of much horror. And Liebling had that and took it with him. It's very hard to imitate. There was nobody else on The New Yorker imitating Liebling, just as there was nobody imitating Murray Kempton or H.L. Mencken, with any success anyway.
Let's hear him just from the top of his also his essay, the Shape of War, and here writing, not exactly irony here, something more modern, maybe two Negro soldiers sat with their legs dangling into two deep parallel slit trenches in the dead-looking land between Gafsa and Senad Station one morning last winter. Each was eating a cold mixture of meat and beans out of a small, shiny tin can capable of reflecting the sun's rays to a distance of several miles in that flat country, and each turned his face upward periodically with mouthful to stare into the hot aluminum-colored sky. You've got modernism right there, blazing right through or beyond what any irony he may have brought.
Yeah, this is before Paul Bowles started writing.
Yeah, unbelievable! It sounds like Paul Bowles. That's right, Proto Bowles.
And one of the wonderful things about this book are the sections on North Africa, because after the fall of France, he came back to New York and then went to cover the Blitz in London and then the invasion of North Africa. And you see him doing what we did not do in the adventure that started 5 years ago. Mm. He went out of his way to understand Muslim culture. He was in Algeria, and years later, in the 50s, he went back to cover the Algerian war against the French. He read the great historian Ibn Khaldun to get a sense of Arabic history, and ended up many years later using him to describe Archie Moore, the light heavyweight champion of the world.
He brought a lot in his pack to that war.
But he brought a lot, and I hope that a few young soldiers can read some of this North Africa stuff.
Pete Hamill, please stand by. We're going to hear much more about A.J. Liebling and his great reporting. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about telling the story of war. The great New York journalist Pete Hamill joins us to look at the war correspondence of legendary New Yorker writer A.J. Liebling on World War II, just out with there's a new volume edited by Pete Hamill, A.J. Liebling, World War II Writings, brought out by the Library of America. And it is absolutely wondrous, wonderful war reporting. Pete Hamill, you've done, among many other things, your own share of war reporting, Vietnam, Nicaragua, Lebanon, I guess Northern Ireland might count. Was this an influence on you? I've read you talking in Saigon with Ward Just, the great correspondent and novelist, about A.J. Liebling, as if he still sort of came with you in your backpack to that war, Vietnam.
I don't think we were the only two guys who went through that.
No,
Ward and I.
Not.
He was, you know, Liebling was such a master that any of his pieces and any of his collections were like seminars to young reporters. So, yes, I remember Ward and I talking about Liebling at the Hotel Caravelle in Saigon and wishing we could do that because we were both working for newspapers. We didn't have the space that Liebling had, which would be 2,000 or 3,000 words. Mm-hmm. We had to get it into 700 words, and which is always a problem with newspaper work. And it's why when Liebling left newspapers, he never went back. But there's so many lessons to be learned even now in the age of cable and instantaneous coverage of almost everything. One of the things that Liebling did was to write about the boring parts, to say that when in combat, it's not always up over the barbed wire and kill the enemy. It's sitting around waiting. And while you're waiting, the conversation that's held is almost never about the enemy. It's about women. It's about books they've read or some story in the newspaper that reach them 4 weeks late. And Liebling is a master of making the boring parts part of the experience of war because they're often left out. When he had to write about combat, which is not the same as writing about war because war involves all kinds of politics and other things, when he wrote about combat, he was exact. He did not exaggerate. He knew that some people got wounded and never saw it coming. He knew that you could stand beside another man, the other man gets killed, and you're standing when it's over. He knew about that stuff. And I think that kind of reporting has been rare out of Iraq. It's a little better out of Afghanistan, but it's rare out of Iraq. But the other thing was not just that. Understanding the culture of where the fighting was going on. You had to do that, and he did the work to fill gaps that he didn't have just by showing up, the French, using French and understanding France and French food and music and all the rest of it. But he worked at it. He said, this is relevant to understanding who these people are. They're not statues in the park. They're human beings one at a time. And so he tried very hard to make his journalism about people one at a time.
And he was invested. He was invested in France as a kind of paragon of Western tradition. Invested in France. I mean, he may have studied Ibn Khaldun and gotten to know the Muslims, but he was invested in this country in a way that few American correspondents in Baghdad can quite be.
Yeah, and he was crushed by the surrender. He really thought the French would fight as they had in World War I, losing 1,400,000 people, by the way, in World War I. And I think because of the immensity of the killing in World War I, nobody was really had the heart to fight again. But it broke Liebling's heart because he loved the French and he defended them in spite of what happened and was absolutely driven to be there when Paris was liberated, and he was.
We want to hear that, but give us just a sense, if you'd be good enough, first, Pete Hamill, of he was on a landing craft for the Normandy invasion on D-Day. He writes in Mali and other pieces and So to Victory about that experience. Could you read just a little bit of that for us, Pete?
This is Liebling speaking. I looked down at the main deck. He's on an LCT, which stood for Landing Craft Tank, which were the landing vehicles. I looked down at the main deck, and the beach battalion men were already moving ahead, so I knew that the ramps must be down. I could hear Long, a soldier, shouting, "Move along now, move along," as if he were unloading an excursion boat at Coney Island. But the men needed no urging. They were moving without a sign of flinching. You didn't have to look far for tracers now. And Callum, a sailor, Callum and I flattened our backs against the pilot house and pulled in our stomachs as if to give a possible bullet an extra couple of inches clearance. Something tickled the back of my neck. I slapped at it and discovered that I had most of the ship's rigging draped around my neck and shoulders like a character in an old slapstick movie about a spaghetti factory. The rigging had been cut away by bullets. As Callum and I looked toward the stern, we could see a tableau that was like a recruiting poster. There was a 20-millimeter rapid-firing gun on the upper deck. Since it couldn't bear forward because of the pilot house, and since there was nothing to shoot at on either side, it was pointed straight up at the sky in readiness for a possible dive-bombing attack. It had a crew of three men, and they were kneeling about it, one on each side, and one behind the gun barrel, all looking up at the sky in an extremely earnest manner and getting all the protection they could out of the gun shield. As a background to the men's heads, an American flag at the ship's stern streamed across the field of vision. It was a new flag, which Rigg, one of the commanders, which Rigg had ordered hoisted for the first time for the invasion, and its colors were brilliant in the sun. So it's a little vignette in a way. It takes us into this place where these men are, and it's part of this much, much larger thing.
A recruiting poster moment, he says, but still he's got the old slapstick movie with the rigging cut away by bullets on his shoulders like spaghetti.
Yeah, because the one thing he won't do, he loves soldiers. Mm. He won't sentimentalize them. Mm-hmm. He's limited because in those days you couldn't have soldiers talk the way all soldiers talk.
With all the salt.
With all the obscenities known to mankind and their compounds.
Yes.
He couldn't do that, although he corrected a few things and put some bad words into the book versions of some of this.
Pete Hamill, reading there from A.J. Liebling, World War II writings. Pete, we've got a lot of listeners who want to talk with you about A.J. Liebling. Let's go to Quebec and Elgin, Quebec, and Tony. Hi, Tony, you're on the air with Pete Hamill.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just going to mention to your guest about Liebling's, he has a post-war book, I can't remember what it was called, but it's about dinner in Paris and restaurants and characters in post-war World War II Paris.
Yeah.
And it reminded me nothing so much of, perhaps as a juxtaposition, but Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London. And Orwell spoke very interestingly about the lower classes in Paris.
Right.
And Liebling was somewhat, he was almost the opposite. He wrote about more or less high-class dinners in Paris. I just thought if your guest could comment upon that.
Well, I think the difference was that Liebling had an expense account as tiny as it was. And poor Orwell was washing dishes in the back.
Different view.
In the back. And Orwell's book is a great book. The Liebling book is called Between Meals, which is apparently about food, but is about so much more, about culture and all kinds of things. And he writes better about food than anybody, and it probably killed him. He died at only 59 years old, and the last few years he was 5'9", 250 pounds, which meant that you couldn't fit in a foxhole, never mind entertain the thought of seeing another one. But he was a great, great writer about food, too.
When you think of Orwell, though, I think more of the homage to Catalonia in terms of war reporting. And there seem many, many similarities, really, there between the two.
Oh, yeah. Down and Out in Paris and London is not about the war. It's about the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
It's set in the Depression.
Mm.
And you're right about the Catalonia book. It's one of the great intelligent looks at war.
Let's get a call from Fairfield, Vermont, and Al. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. First, I want to say hello to Pete Hamill. I think his book, A Drinking Life, is one of the great books. About A.J. Liebling, I still have a dog-eared copy, paperback copy, of The Press by Liebling. He was one of the great critics about the ambivalence of the press, the corruption of the press, the bias of the press. I wish most of the reporters at the New York Times would very seriously read that book by Liebling.
I'm sure some of them have. there's several collections of the press criticism. He did about 80 articles as a press critic starting in 1951. And they were amazingly good because he was not an ideologue. He wasn't saying this guy is not a socialist or this guy's not blah, blah, blah. He was a craftsman, and he was looking at the other guy's craft because he knew about it. And the Library of America that has published the war book, we're doing a second volume, too, that will have a lot of the press stuff in it and a lot of his boxing writing because he was one of the great boxing writers of the 20th century, too. But I agree that reading about the press makes you a better reader of newspapers, and they're still fresh in certain ways, even though it's about newspapers that are dead and gone and newspaper men, too, alas.
The time of high romance with newspapers and Liebling fully in the grip of that. Al, thanks for your call. Let's get one more right here, if we may, from Fred in Newton, Massachusetts. Fred, you're on the air with Pete Hamill.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Pete. I'm intrigued with Pete's view of a reporter really bringing a war to life for the folks back home. And you're doing it in respect to the Iraq War and the Afghan War, but as I read the budgets of the U.S., we're fighting three other major wars, the War on Terror, which, of course, is a worldwide thing, War on Drugs, and the Star Wars or Space Wars. And I'm wondering, Pete, if you can comment on do we need a reporter for those? Do we need somebody who's bringing those to life? Because they're sort of so far under the radar scope that they're almost invisible and still spending billions.
You know, Fred, and Pete, there's a moment and where Liebling himself talks about the dropping the atomic bombs, and the New York Times writer who was on board, I think the Enola Gay,
right,
says maybe it'll be scientists in the future that write about war.
I think he felt that was coming, but it's still there's nothing gratifying at all about today's wars. But I think he would have known that the only way you get it done was with foot soldiers. No matter how much science you have, how much shock and awe you inflict on people from 20,000 feet, it's still the guy, the foot soldier, that has to fight it. And I think he would have been amazingly sympathetic to those soldiers, those both the ones in the field and the ones trying to get the rest of their lives together. And Walter Reed and too many other hospitals.
Those soldiers still in the field today as we speak.
Yeah.
Pete
yeah.
Hamill, I want to bring in a voice in, if I may, from Eflin, North Carolina. Very happy to have Gerhard Weinberg with us, professor emeritus at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, author of A World at Arms, A Global History of World War II. Professor Weinberg, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
You know this war, and you've paid a lot of attention to how it was conveyed at the time and over time, World War II. What do we learn from A.J. Liebling about World War II that we didn't learn from others that we should bear in mind today as we look out on war around the world?
Well, we learn things that engage the reality for those who participate and those who live in the area where the war takes place. It is true that today, with television, which did not exist at the time, we have very much more in the way of visual images that at the time of World War II were restricted to newsreels, which would follow or precede a feature in the movies.
Right.
And such picture magazines as Alive. But the images that people could construct for themselves of what was going on in reality was not so much visual as it is today. It tended to take, to put it crudely, print form.
Mm-hmm.
People, of course, could listen to the radio, but they read newspapers. They saw maps in newspapers of where the front was and whether it had or had not moved from day to day. They read and sometimes heard on the radio correspondence. And Liebling, it seems to me, gave people at home who were by definition literally thousands of miles removed from fighting in Tunisia or France or anywhere else, a sense of what this actually involved and meant for their husbands, fathers, brothers, sons who were over there, and for what this meant for the local people in whose front and backyards and homes, this war was in fact going on.
You know, and yet, Pete Hamill, for all the television images out of Iraq, I read A.J. Liebling on World War II, and I feel my mind more stuffed with images that I won't forget than, you know, all the stand-ups next to a palm tree in Baghdad and aftermath of a suicide bombing. Images I've seen.
Yeah, I think, but the professor's absolutely right. It was language that was telling us this, which meant that we as an audience, I was 10 when the war ended, but I can still hear some of those broadcasts. They were made of words, and we had to imagine the reality that matched those words. Television does all the work for you, and there are some good, brave television reporters, including many women in this war.
More on A.J. Liebling with Pete Hamill and Gerhard Weinberg in a moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about telling the story of war. The great New York journalist Pete Hamill joins us to look at the war correspondence of legendary New Yorker writer A.J. Liebling on World War II. There's a new volume out edited by Pete Hamill, A.J. Liebling, World War II Writings, brought out by the Library of America. Gerhard Weinberg joins us as well, professor emeritus at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, author of A World at Arms. He joins us from Eflin, North Carolina. We're very glad to have him. Let's take caller Mark from Hingham, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Just a minor point. I was really struck with the image of that was read by Liebling of the of Liebling with the spaghetti rope around him and the American flag
on D-Day. Yeah,
and then hearing the professor from talk about how TV brings us all the images, it really struck me that the images from the writing, from the print media, is so much more effective. When you see, you know, the pictures of the war in Iraq over again, it's almost like it's just much less effective, and it's paradoxical.
It
that
is, isn't it?
The visuals actually seem more effective when you create the image in your mind from words.
Yeah, Mark, thank you for that. And Pete, I wish you'd read just a bit more to drive that home. I mean, maybe it's the human heart, the human intelligence that is brought to creating that image that makes it so real. Of course, Liebling loved Paris, and you've got a bit there from the time of liberation.
Yeah.
Direction Paris, letter from Paris. The top of that you've described as your favorite of all this, the joy, the empathy that he's got there, and the images, they're just great. I wish you'd read for us, Pete.
Yeah. It's September of 1944. For the first time in my life, and probably the last, I have lived for a week in a great city where everybody is happy. Moreover, since this city is Paris, everybody makes this euphoria manifest. To drive along the boulevards in a jeep is like walking into some as yet unmade René Clair film, with hundreds of bicyclists coming toward you in a stream that divides before the jeep just when you feel sure that a collision is imminent. Among the bicyclists, there are pretty girls, their hair dressed high on their heads in what seems to be the current mode here. These girls show legs of a length and slimness and firmness and brownness never associated with French womanhood. Food restrictions and the amount of bicycling that is necessary in getting around in a big city without any other means of transportation have endowed these girls with the best figures in the world, which they will doubtless be glad to trade in for 3 square meals, plentiful supplies of chocolate, and a seat in the family Citroën as soon as the situation becomes more normal. There are handsome young matrons with children mounted behind them on their bikes, and there are husky young workmen, stubby little bureaucrats in striped pants, and old professors in wing collars and chin whiskers, all of them smiling and all of them lifting their right hands from the handlebars to wave as they go past. The most frequently repeated phrase of the week is, "At last one breathes."
Paris. Liberated there by in A.G. Liebling's writing. And Pete, you know, you can't help feel there. I mean, for all the horrors of this war, this was an old-fashioned contest with a beginning and a middle, fear and suffering, but then an end. And that joy, it seems too much to look forward to anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And it's free. In an odd way, I hate to in any way think that Vietnam was better than anything. But even in Vietnam, there was one element that's in the current wars that was absent in Paris when Liebling arrived. It's religion. There's no religious supernatural basis for the enmity. It was about nationalism in Vietnam more than it was about Marxism. And in Paris, it was about ideology in a sense that Nazism was an ideology, but it was about human life and the value of human values. It was liberals against right-wingers. It was an amazing, it had an amazing simplicity to it. Mm. Today, everything is complicated by the religious quarrel in Iraq and increasingly in Afghanistan. And that's a big difference and makes it very tough to write about.
Gerhard Weinberg, as an historian, when you read A.J. Liebling, it's beautiful. It's affecting. It's, of course, still journalism. Do you see this as romance or reality? Do you look at it as a record of the war or a record of one sparkling individual's experience?
Well, what seems to me very important in the journalism of Liebling and some of the other World War II correspondents that simply cannot be conveyed by the current plethora of images is the alternation between boredom and terror that characterizes military activities. There isn't really any way that you can put on television the fact that many times for hours and days on end, there's nothing going on, that people are bored, that they are waiting, that they may be frightened. There are all kinds of things going on inside them, but there's nothing going on, and it's very difficult to show nothing on television. And then there comes this sudden event, this moment of terror, which can be conveyed, to be sure, in a picture, but then flashes from the screen again. It is the writer, and this is what one thing that I believe Liebling was particularly good at, was to give the person back home a sense of this alternation, if you will, of waiting, boredom, nothing, and then the sudden flash of excitement, of terror, of movement, of all manner of activity, of events, of explosions. This alternation, if you will, excuse me, between perhaps internal fear, worry, covered over by conversation that frequently cannot be repeated.
Yeah.
And then suddenly there are enormous events.
The maelstrom.
And this alternation. And then the same thing is true for the people in the area where the war is taking place.
For whom it's home, that kind of long tempo from, as you say, the ordinary to the chaos, that is clearly, very clearly captured here. Pete Hamill, our time grows short. Last thoughts on Liebling as the country sits thinking about the wars in its lap right now. What do you think he'd make of these wars? Are these wars he could go out with the same joie de vivre and cover? Does it matter?
I think it does. It would have a different tone, but I think he'd do what he did with World War II and which all good journalists do. He made literature out of a transitory medium. And Ezra Pound, who was a crackpot on many things but a very good estimator of writing, once said that literature is news that stays news. And I think that fits the Odyssey and it fits Mr. Liebling when you read him, particularly if you're reading him for the first time.
It's a beautiful trail, even as it winds through war. Pete Hamill, we're very grateful to you for doing the editing on this new volume. It's one to read and read again, and it's been wonderful having you this hour. Pete, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Pete Hamill, thank you for having me.
Gerhard
Weinberg at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thank you very much, Professor Weinberg.
Glad to be with you.
The new volume is A.J. Liebling, World War II Writings. In a moment, remembering science fiction great Arthur C. Clarke. This is On Point. Arthur C. Clarke, the author of 2001, A Space Odyssey, and widely acclaimed as perhaps the 20th century's greatest science fiction writer, died early Wednesday in Colombo, Sri Lanka. He was 90 years old. He wrote nearly 100 books. With his scientific knowledge and his novelistic talent, he helped usher in the space age, as the New York Times put it in its obituary today. Astronauts and eminent scientists pointed to his influence on America's and the world's attitudes about space. Joining me now from Fairhope, Alabama, is Tedson Myers. He's chairman of the Arthur C. Clarke Foundation, which presents annual awards to achievers and students in the space field. He visited Clarke just last month in Sri Lanka. Tedson Myers, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi.
And with us from Arlington, Vermont, is Andrew Chaikin, science historian and author of Man on the Moon, the best-selling chronicle of the Apollo moon missions. Andy Chaikin, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Tedson Myers, first to you. You saw Arthur C. Clarke in Sri Lanka just last month. What was on his mind?
We talked a bit about the Clarke Center, or the institute we're trying to get organized at UNLV to study human imagination, which was our particular way, we think, of honoring Arthur. Aside from that, he was it was quite clear that he was ailing. He wasn't in the sparkling shape that, despite the wheelchair, that I'd seen him in three times before out there.
Andy Chaikin, for a generation of Americans, when the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey came out, 1968, I mean, here was a man, a movie kind of defining a vision of the future. People trooped into it, you know, in hordes to sort of say this is. In all its kind of mysticism and its technology, HAL, the computer, and the monolith, and the apes, and all the rest, this is where we've been. This is where we're heading. Here we are now, well after 2001. Arthur Clarke still framing a moment that has passed by, or is it still in front of us? How do you look at the images he created?
Well, I look at them in a particular way as somebody who is passionately believes in the value of space exploration as a kind of a touchstone, and it's been, for me, something that I've gone back to again and again and again to kind of renew my sense of hope and excitement, because to me and to countless other space-struck kids of that generation, 2001 was an advertisement for the future, and that was very much in keeping with what Arthur Clarke gave us even before the space age began. I mean, my God, in 1945, this was at a time when people thought that the first satellites would be a long way off, never mind sending people into space. Arthur Clarke proposed that it would be possible to put satellites at a height of about 22,000 miles above the Earth, at which point they would orbit at just the right speed to appear to hover over a certain point on the Earth. That is, their orbital speed would match the Earth's rotation. And by doing so, you would create essentially a communications outpost in orbit. And if you put three of them up, they would be able to together cover the entire globe. And that became the basis for what today is an essential part of our lives with all of the communication satellites we have up there. So Clarke was, to the end, a visionary. And to me, it's been fascinating to see some of his predictions come true, as in the communication satellites, and he wrote about humans walking on the moon a decade or more before it actually happened. Well, more than a decade before it happened, almost two decades before it happened. And yet, his vision stretched farther than we have been able to truly realize, as 2001 shows. We don't have humans living on other worlds in bases. We don't have computers like HAL that can simulate human intelligence. We don't have the other magnificent infrastructure in space that he prophesied. But the most important thing about Arthur Clarke is that he always challenged us to say our limitations are only in our minds, and the way to supersede those limitations are also in our imaginations and our creativity.
You know, it's interesting to hear you say that, because in a musing that someone picked up in literature, he was heard to say what he'd like to have on his gravestone. Realize Arthur Clarke, he never grew up, but he never stopped growing.
Are we still living in a vision of space in the future framed, Ted Sedmeyer, by Arthur Clarke?
Oh, I think so. There have been others, of course, and they influenced Arthur. H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, but without a doubt, and I think the reason is because Arthur's applied his. Remember, he was trained as a physicist and mathematician, not as a writer in the first place. Yes, the answer is yes, because he brought to it such an understanding of the science, to which, of course, he added fiction, but he added it in such an ethical context that always he was asking, I think, the same question. What do we owe our universe? What do we owe ourselves in finding the future, and how do we treat each other?
And I think it's important to note also that he was not a Pollyanna when it came to foreseeing the future. He envisioned the negative possibilities of technology. He believed, I heard him say a few times as the turn of the millennium approached, that it wouldn't be long before the Internet became a conscious entity and all the computers. And I hope I'm quoting him correctly. Maybe you'll correct me if I'm wrong. But we ran some risk of not being the boss anymore eventually as our computers got smarter and smarter.
He painted that very effectively in 2001, and now no longer with us. Arthur C. Clarke dead yesterday in Sri Lanka at 90. Andy Chaikin and Ted Sedmeyer, thank you very much for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.